I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is March 4th, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take the attendance by roll.
Chair Hansen is present. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz present.
Wasilewicz present. Heintzeman, Josh.
Present.
Acorn, Patty.
Present.
Acklin, Susan.
Present.
Thacker, Jeff.
Thacker present.
Thacker, Finn, Jamie.
Present.
Acklin, Rob.
Present.
Fisher, Peter.
Fisher present.
Green, Steve.
Green present.
Igo, Spencer.
Present.
Jordan, Sydney.
Present.
Keeler, Heather.
Present.
Lippert, Todd.
Lippert present.
Lewick, Dale.
Lewick present.
Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison present.
Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson present.
Tice, Tama.
Present.
A quorum is present.
Quorum is present. The next item agenda is the minutes for Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021. Representative Igo, have you looked at the minutes? Maybe Representative Nathan Nelson.
Yes, I have, and I moved the minutes from the previous meeting.
Representative Nathan Nelson moves the minutes for March 2nd, 2021. All those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed? Ayes have it. Minutes are approved. House File 1250, Representative Becker Finn, the 2021 Lands Bill. We've allocated till about 1:25 for this bill. Representative Becker Finn, will you move that House File 1250 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
So moved, Mr. Chair. And now that the bill is in front of us, I would also like to move the A4 amendment.
Representative Becker Finn moves the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape she would like. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. The A4 is adopted. Representative Becker Finn to the bill as amended.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I know we already did one lands bill this year, but that was the cleanup from 2020. So this is now the new 2021 lands bill. For members who are newer to this, every year there's a DNR lands bill, and it's because there's legislative authorization required in order for the DNR to make changes to state parks, state forests, and if there are surplus lands that are riparian land, so land that borders water. And so that's what this is this year. I'm going to turn it over in just a minute to the DNR to walk through the bill, and then we'll be happy to take questions from members. The A4 amendment included several provisions requested from members who had standalone bills that fall into the same category of selling state land, including Representative Lewick's bill, Representative Burkle, Representative Igo, Representative Sandstead, Representative Eklund, several different places throughout the state that fell into this category, and I'm happy to move those forward as part of this larger bill. And with that, I will turn it over to Amy Schwartz from the Department of Natural Resources.
Welcome, Ms. Schwartz. If you could introduce yourself and who you are with for the record.
Chair, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Amy Schwartz, and I'm an attorney at the Department of Natural Resources at the Minnesota DNR, and I'll be walking you through the 2021 Lands Bill today. As you know, each year the Lands Bill includes different amendments to statutes affecting DNR-administered state land or land transactions and changes to state park boundaries, authorization to sell certain riparian land, and authorization to sell certain tax forfeit land. The 2021 Lands Bill has quite a few provisions, and I'll walk through each one today, and then I'm happy to answer any questions. And Susan Damon, the Assistant Director of Lands and Minerals, is here today as well, and so is Patty Thielen, who's our Northeast Region Director, and she can answer questions about the Riverland State Forest proposal. So the 2021 Lands Bill proposes to resolve a funding issue with cultural resource reviews for real estate transactions at the DNR. These cultural resource reviews are conducted by archaeologists from the Minnesota Historical Society who are under contract with the DNR. The archaeologists perform reviews to check for historical and tribal resources, artifacts, and sites when there's a utility license, lease, or easement proposed on state land. Currently, the DNR uses program funds to cover the costs to pay the archaeologists who actually work for the Minnesota Historical Society when we do these reviews. So the proposal would shift the costs of review, monitoring, and other services to the applicants who are requesting the use of state land. I'll walk through the specific sections that would amend the relevant statutes as we go forward. So section one would amend Minnesota Statute 84.415 to include language that would require reimbursement, as I just discussed, with utility licenses and permits. Section 2 would amend Minnesota Statute Section 84.63 to include language that would require reimbursement in connection with easements to other government units. Section 3 would amend Minnesota Statute 84.631 to include language that would require reimbursement to easements to private persons. And then Section 4, changing gears a little bit, would designate the Riverland State Forest in Carlton and St. Louis counties along the St. Louis, Whiteface, and Cloquet Rivers. There's a map included in your briefing material, and I will share my screen, so hopefully you can get a sense of this proposal. So let's see. Hopefully that is working. So this proposal would designate approximately 22,596 acres of land as a new state forest. These lands are already under DNR management and ownership. They've been administered by a number of different divisions for years now, and putting them all into a state forest outdoor unit of REC would provide for more efficient management, multiple recreation uses, and sustainable forest management. Tribal, state, county, and local stakeholders have been involved and all support the designation. And this proposal would add, would establish the 60th state forest in the outdoor recreation system under Minnesota Statute 89.021. Section 5 would amend Minnesota Statute Section 89.17 to include language about reimbursement, as I previously discussed, in connection with leases and permits involving state forest land. And Section 6 would amend Minnesota Statute 8250 to include language that would require reimbursement in connection with leasing state lands. Section 7, I will show you two more maps. Section 7 would add 473 acres to Lake Vermilion Sudan Underground Mine State Park in St. Louis County. A little background on this proposal. In 1992, the Dayton family gifted a conservation easement on this property to the state of Minnesota, and both fee, title, and the conservation easements. So the deed that granted us the conservation easement reserves the rights to use the land to the family, sort of comparable to fee ownership, until December 31st, 2035. After that, all ownership rights will transfer to the state. Based on the intent of the grantors and the conservation easement terms, which will continue in perpetuity, the DNR took a look at this and determined that it would be best managed as part of a state park. There's a letter of support in your briefing materials from the Dayton family. I'll show you one more map related to this. So this map, the red portion and this little island is the conservation easement and the proposal. The green here is Cabotogama State Forest, and the brown kind of on the corner of the screen is the current state park. So although the property would actually not become part of the state park until 2035, designating it now would allow Parks and Trails to dedicate resources to come up with a management plan and get ready for that time. This state park addition would amend Minnesota Statute Section 85.012, Subdivision 38A. Section 8 would delete 0.26 acres from Minneopa State Park. And I will show you a picture and a map here. The picture you can see, we tried to outline about where the property is, and then this map is a little more detail of where the deletion is in the park. This boundary change is proposed because there was a landslide and there's a railroad nearby, and the landslide caused some damage on the railroad property, and they put in some stabilization materials. When they did that, they inadvertently trespassed on state land, and their stabilization materials are on state land. So in order to continue to allow them to stabilize the bank, the DNR plans to sell this small parcel to the railroad and amend the boundary. It's not an actively used part of the park. Section 9 establishes the boundaries of Riverland State Forest, as we discussed before, and it contains a very long legal description. And Section 10 authorizes the private sale of 0.71 acres of land to the city of Big Lake. This is surplus riparian land in Sherburne County. The city currently has done some management on this area, and the Lake Association has placed some improvements on this channel. The sale will allow the city to fully manage the channel, and there's a resolution and a letter of support from the city in your briefing materials. Chair and Representative Becker Finn, would you like me to discuss the tax forfeit sale parcels?
I think so. Yeah, why not?
Okay. Chair, Representatives, so there were a number of tax forfeit sales that were also proposed in the A4 amendment. Section 10, which I assume will have to be renumbered since we already have a Section 10, is a private sale of tax forfeit land in Aiken County, and this was previously introduced. The DNR has reviewed and does not have any concerns. Section 11 is authorization to sell, lease, or convey land owned in Goodhue County. The DNR has reviewed this and has no concerns. Section 12 authorizes two private sales of tax forfeit land in Itasca County. DNR has reviewed and has no concerns. Section 13 authorizes a private sale of surplus riparian island located in War Road River to a local unit of government at below market value. This island is located in the city of War Road and is commonly referred to as Government Island. There's community interest in developing this into a park, and if approved, the DNR will convey this property to a unit of local government subject to a reversionary clause and a flowage easement. Section 14 authorizes private sales of tax forfeit land in St. Louis County. This was introduced as House File 1595, I believe. Section 15 authorizes St. Louis County and the DNR to lease land for a water intake treatment project for longer than the usual authorized lease authority. This is a bonding funded project, and the lease needs to be longer than the usual terms to meet the bonding requirements. This was introduced as File 1596. Did I forget Section 14, which authorizes a private sale of tax forfeit land in St. Louis County, and this was introduced as 1595. So that concludes my remarks. Thank you for your time and attention today. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and my DNR colleagues are here to answer questions as well.
Thank you. Before Representative Heinzman, Ms. Taylor, do we need a oral amendment just to authorize renumbering the sections appropriately after the amendment, or was that in the A4 amendment?
Mr. Chair, that's in the A4, and actually we usually like them to keep them in alphabetical order. That's why it's going to be the new 10.
Okay.
So actually it's correct in the amendment.
So you did the work.
That's right.
Okay. Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just curious if, and it might have been covered. I apologize, Ms. Schwartz, if I messed it up. But do you have any acreage information for the parcels in the A4 amendment? Do we have any idea how big that is? Just wanted to confirm. I don't think there's anything controversial there, but I was just wanting to get that information if you had it at hand.
Chair Representative Heitzman, we have just a little bit of that acreage information. So for Aiken County, we know that that parcel is 15.4 acres. And I know that Government Island is 6.7 acres, but I don't have the acreage for the rest of the tax forfeit parcels at this time.
Representative Heitzman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The follow-up would be just confirming that there isn't any known opposition at the local level to any of these transfers. I know you mentioned, Ms. Forrest, that there was a number that there was confirmed to be lots of agreement. Is there anything that we're aware of in the bill that has been controversial and that members should have? I see the bill author nodding, or I should say, indicating no.
And we do have another testifier from St. Louis County, but Ms. Schwartz.
Chair and Representative Heitzman, I'm not aware of any opposition. And in fact, the Sherburne County sale and the Roseau County sale, we have, I would say, overwhelming community support. These are really community-led projects. Those are the two I'm most familiar with.
Very good.
Representative Heitzman. Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got just a couple of questions. And there's a lot of new language in there where it says, in addition to fees specified in this section, the applicant must reimburse the Commissioner of Natural Resources for the costs incurred for reviewing, monitoring, and it goes on and on. And the language is the same in different sections. And so right now, who's is the Department of Natural Resources covering these costs?
Ms. Schwartz.
Chair and Representative Green, yes. Currently, the Department of Natural Resources covers the costs for these cultural historical reviews. And right now, we're using a variety of different program funds to cover these costs.
Okay, then, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you. Then just a comment. You know, it seems like this is really part of the DNR's job. And so now we're going to be passing on more costs. It's not something that bothers me, and I see it happening more and more. So I'm not really too comfortable with that. But I have one more question, and I don't know if Ms. Schwartz can answer it or if there's another testifier that might be able to answer it. But in the A4 amendment, there's a couple of spots in here that I've never seen before in like tax forfeited lands. And in particular, if you can look on 4.20 of the amendment, where it talks about the Attorney General now has to approve, the form must be approved, and then the Attorney General can make changes to the land descriptions. And I'm wondering if that was standard and I'd missed it before, or if that's new, and if it is new, why add it?
Ms. Schwartz.
Chair Representative Green, that is standard language that I think we started adding that a few years ago, because occasionally once we get further into the land transaction, we might find a change. Our survey staff would review the legal description and they might propose some slightly different language. So in terms of the language about changing the legal description, that's why we have that in there, just to make changes so we don't have to come back to you and get another amendment if there's a slight change to the legal description. And in terms of the Attorney General's office, I think that reference is in there because of some of their authorities, but I can double check that.
Representative Green.
Just one more question, and I don't think, if she can't answer it now, that's fine. I'd like a description of minor changes or technical changes, because you're changing the description of the land, that could potentially be something that could be controversial. So if you could maybe let me know at some time what you consider to be like a minor or technical change to land description. Thank you.
Ms. Schwartz, if you can get that to him later. Representative Becker-Finn.
Yeah, a couple things. I think it's important to note for the record that the changes regarding paying for those costs with the the work with the Historical Society, it's cost. It's not creating a fee. And for many of the cases, it's someone from the Historical Society essentially checking a database to make sure that it's fine. And the cost may actually be very small in most cases. But in the cases where it does get more involved, I think it does make sense that the person wanting to make those changes to easements and, is helping to pay for that. I'm sure if we want to start including that and, we want to start funding the DNR more, I'm sure that they would not be opposed to that. Further, I just wanted to clarify, because I wasn't sure exactly what, just to be clear with Representative Green's concern with the Attorney General, it's talking about changing the language, the land descriptions in the conveyance. It isn't about changing the description of the land, period, but about changing the wording in the conveyance. And so I just want to be clear about that, that it, I'm sure that the Attorney General is fully aware of the impacts of, messing with any legal descriptions that are needed in outstanding deeds or whatever it is, real estate instruments have to be technically very accurate for anyone who has bought or sold a home. And so I am certain that that's something that they're fully aware of.
We do have one other testifier, Julie Marinucci, St. Louis County.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. I'm here to just answer any questions you may have on the tax forfeited land parcels and the leasing that are referenced in the bill. So if you've got any questions, I'm here to answer them. Thank you.
Ms. Marinucci, if you could just introduce yourself for the record and who you're with.
Thank you, Chair. Julie Marinucci, Deputy Director for St. Louis County Lands and Minerals.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Representative Becker Finn, closing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think, some of the comments from members is a good, the things that were added in the A4 were at the request of other members, many of them members of your caucus. So if you have additional questions, I'd encourage you to reach out to them. And in the future, for all of us to remember, when the lands bill is introduced, if you know there are things that you're going to want to be included in that, if we had that information sooner ahead of time, we probably could have gotten more information ahead of time on the acreage and found the maps and done some of that legwork as well. So thank you for the discussion and appreciate the support for this bill.
Representative Becker Finn renews her motion that House File 1250, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Hanson, Rick.
Hanson, Rick, aye.
Wazlowick, Amy.
Wazlowick, aye.
Wazlowick, aye. Heinzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heinzman, aye. Acomb, Patty.
Aye.
Acomb, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Becker Finn, Jamie.
Aye.
Becker Finn, aye. Eklund, Rob.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Fisher, Peter. Fisher, Peter. Green, Steve.
No.
Green, no. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Sydney. Jordan, Sydney. Keeler, Heather.
Aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Tice, aye.
And then to go back, Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. And Jordan, Sydney? Jordan, Sydney? That is 17 ayes and one nay.
Mr. Chair, you're muted.
Oh, you didn't get to hear the puck. The motion is approved. And I'm going to turn the puck or the gavel over to Vice Chair Wazlowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next on the agenda is House File 639,
And before we move the bill and the DE2 amendment, we're going to hear a presentation from the Clean Water Council and the state agencies on their Clean Water Fund recommendations. And we have time slotted for this until 2 p.m. And first up on the agenda is Frank Jewell. Mr. Jewell, if you could introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. I think Paul Gardner is going to pop up some slides. So thank you. This is Frank Jewell. I'm a St. Louis County Commissioner and Chair of the Clean Water Council. And I'm just going to introduce what we have done, and then Paul will take over and give you the details. It's not very long. I think you all know the Clean Water Council was established in 2006 as part of the Clean Water Legacy Act, and was to foster coordination and cooperation among agencies. We have 17 voting members. You can see the list there. They include folks from municipal governments, from townships, from counties, but also farm organizations, environmental organizations, tribal government, et cetera. It's a broad and wide-ranging group of folks, and it is their job to consider the requests from the departments and others, and then make recommendations and a report to the legislature and the governor by the 5th of December in the year prior to a new budget being considered. Next slide. The major part of what the Clean Water does is reach out to the public for public input. This last year and a half worked really hard in developing a strategic plan and setting priorities, and also figuring out how we might evaluate the ongoing investment that is being made and what kind of impact it's having. There were 70 proposals heard, presented by the departments and others. At the time this was considered, it was thought that we would have a budget of $220 million for the biennium, and the report to the legislature that you received is based on that assessment. And though we learned right a day before the report was to be submitted that it would be higher, we submitted it at the $220 million mark. I would say that everybody practically within this took a bit of a haircut so that we could get to $220 million. We now know that there's $256 million available as of the February forecast, $36 million more. And we will be going back to the table to think about if we will make recommendations to the legislature and the governor about how to use those funds. Part of that may be considering increasing the amounts for proposals we heard and funded but gave a haircut to. The last thing, of course, is the governor and the council's recommendations have come in the same. So with that, I'll pass it off to Paul.
Mr. Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Gardner. I'm the administrator for the Clean Water Council, and I'll just pause so someone can tell me if I'm muted or not.
You're good.
Thank you. I'll just give you a brief overview here. As Chair Jewell mentioned, the Clean Water Council sought a lot of public input in the last 2 years as we formulated a strategic plan that would chart the progress of the Clean Water Fund through 2034 when the legacy amendment expires. One polite complaint or piece of constructive criticism we received is that legislators and other stakeholders couldn't really tell how all the line items that are in the recommendations you see before you fit together into a cohesive strategy. So the good news is we did put together a strategic plan that lays out indicators of what would happen by 2034. And in the recommendations document you have as an attachment or a handout, we do try and draw connections. I have tried to come up with a nifty graphical chart that tries to show all those interconnections, but it either looks like a Jackson Pollock painting or one of those Kevin Bacon six generations separation graphs, and it just didn't work. So we'll have to try here. The basic approach taken with all these line items that are connected is that we try and test the waters to figure out what's wrong with them, come up with a plan for how to get waters unimpaired, train people how to take what's in the plan and increase their capacity to solve the problem. In some cases, persuade landowners to act. We do spend a lot of clean water funds on persuasion because private property owners don't have to adopt best management practices for water quality, and we want to make sure that they make that choice. In some cases, especially through easements, land is set aside to protect high-quality waters, and when necessary, money is spent by the Clean Water Fund to restore waters, such as you see a lakefront restoration here, or it could be a stream restoration where there once was a ditch. And then when projects are completed, there are more resources being dedicated now in our monitoring budget towards evaluation to see if all these projects are paying off with real results. Next slide, please. The second constructive criticism we received from stakeholders is they were not really sure what our expectations should be for clean water by 2034 when the money expires. In 2014, agencies got together to see what can we realistically do when it comes to getting our waters to meet expectations and get off the impaired waters list. It's believed that we can get two-thirds of our waters to be fishable and 70% to be swimmable by 2034, and we're within reach of those goals. The reason that we're not shooting for 100% is because there are lakes, rivers, and streams that are impaired that we really can't do much about. So mercury, airborne pollution from coal-burning power plants and substandard mining operations around the world contribute airborne deposition of mercury in our lakes. We have roughly 50 lakes in the state with a heavy focus on the metro where de-icing salts have impaired lakes for chlorides. And we are not really going to use desalinization plants to get rid of that salt. And there are another 75 lakes or so that are very close to being impaired. So those are lakes where we really can't do a whole lot. There are some cases where there are low priority waters where spending money on that may not be such a great idea. So we don't want to have swimming beaches in public drainage ditches, for example. So the final thing on measurement is just that we do spend quite a bit of money in the state on protection strategies. This is where we have high quality waters that we keep as high quality waters, especially through protecting land from disturbance. But the problem is you can't measure change. You're essentially not losing any progress. So that's awfully hard to measure. Next slide, please. Just this is my Jackson Pollock painting of sorts. Just to give you an idea how we prioritize and target money with the Clean Water Fund, with a strong foundation in science and planning, agencies with local partners are able to identify in 80 major watersheds all the activities that need to take place on the left by a certain year to get a certain reduction in pollutants, and we know how much those things are going to cost. So by 2023, we'll have this to-do list for every watershed in the state. By 2025 or so, we'll have a comprehensive plan that local stakeholders have put together to help prioritize which one of those things on the to-do list gets done first, and those are funded in part by the Clean Water Fund. Planning and measurement and science does have a cost, but it is cheaper than guessing. And so by using some prioritization and targeting, we're able to better spend taxpayer money to get the desired results. Next slide, please. Just wrapping up here, the Clean Water Fund and the Legacy Amendment were meant to do things that we could not do with existing funds. And so whenever we can, we like to show where that additionality has taken place. I just have a chart here from the Department of Agriculture showing how the funding from the lottery as well as the Clean Water Fund allows us to detect more pesticides and analyze those pesticides. And you can see the bump right after the passage of the legacy amendment. But there are several things in statute that we're asked to really do or allowed to do. One of them is enhanced compliance. We actually have a higher compliance rate with septic system inspections than we used to because of the Clean Water Fund. About almost two-thirds of the Clean Water Fund is spent on technical assistance and grants and other funds that leave the state. The bill you see before you has state agencies listed and the university, but 63% of that money leaves the state to be used by local partners and landowners. I think just the last thing I'll say here is that the Clean Water Fund is often something that unlocks other dollars. So for every dollar that's spent in the Clean Water Fund, we can document 95 cents of additional funds from private, local, state, and federal sources. That does not include a lot of the in-kind landowner contributions, which would be substantially more. So we get a lot of value. And often the hardest dollar to raise for big projects is the first one. And the Clean Water Fund is usually the first dollar raised. Next slide, please. And then I'm going to hand it over to Katrina Kessler, chair of the Interagency Coordination Team and Assistant Commissioner for Water at the MPCA. Thank you.
Ms. Kessler. Thank
you, Chair Wozlik. Can you hear me?
Yep.
So thank you to you and the committee members for the opportunity to be here today to present the governor's and the Clean Water Council's shared recommendation. We really appreciate the time and energy that went into the preparation of the budget on the behalf of the Clean Water Councils, particularly their strategic plan and the coordinative public process they facilitated. You will hear that Clean Water Fund activities are integrated across agencies, and as Paul noted, they're done in concert with state, local, and other partners, and each component of the system leverages the other's complementary work. So as we near the mid-course of the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment, we appreciate the continued partnership, both with the council as well as with our local partners. And I think, as Paul noted, it's really important for all of us to continue to look at where we are versus where we want to be and to take stock of lessons learned as we move forward. The MPCA's proposal that is detailed in one of the attachments that the committee received includes support for monitoring of vulnerable aquifers, as well as the biological, chemical, and habitat of lakes and streams and rivers across the state, data analysis of those conditions to inform trends and determine where we have impairments and where, if previous water impairments existed, if they've been restored, and to track changes over time. The other component on the slide is the restoration and protection strategies, RAPs. These include the cleanup reports called the total maximum daily loads, which are developed in partnership with locals and detail strategies for restoring impaired waters and protecting unimpaired waters. We also highlight implementation, which includes continued cleanup of the St. Louis River AOC, which, as Paul called out, leverages lots of other monies, including the Great Lake Restoration Initiative, EPA, Office of Research and Development funds, and U.S. Army Corps funds, as well as local funds, to make progress on that important work. Other implementation activities at the MPCA include technical assistance to wastewater and stormwater permit holders and communities looking to reduce chloride, and grants to replace chloride-intensive water softeners and failing septic systems. In all, we work on this in concert with our partners, and we understand the urgency to continue to move on this work. And then the second thing I just want to highlight, because I think we spend a lot of time harping on how many waters are impaired, and it's easy to get it caught up in that. And I want to just highlight a success story, which kind of rolls into it all of the work you'll hear about. This is the Plum Creek watershed, the Plum Creek located in the Mississippi River and Warner Lake in Stearns County, in between the Mississippi River and Warner Lake in Stearns County. It was previously impaired for E. coli, and a local industrious township supervisor Jerry Finch worked with the local soil and water conservation districts in Stern County to gain his certification specialist and then formed a neighborhood Plum Creek network and worked closely with the MPCA to do additional monitoring that pinpointed where the bacteria were coming from, and that included stream bank erosion as well as septic systems. And then, as Paul called out, we worked with local partners and led by the soil and water conservation districts to implement fixes. And ultimately, in the last round, the Plum Creek was delisted. And so I think it's important to call out that we do have success stories and we want to see more of this. So we appreciate the support. And I now will turn it over to my colleague, Jason Meckel from the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Meckel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Ecological and Water Resources. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. There are a lot of programs that the DNR implements with the support of the Clean Water Funds. We're not going to cover all of those today, but we did want to highlight for you some of the main things that are present here in this biennium's recommendation and underscore some of the points that Paul and Katrina made. One of the things that, as we've been completing some of that assessment work, we're seeing a need for an increased emphasis supporting our local government partners and implementers with their various projects. And this comes in the form of in helping to inform their plans, identifying where the high priority resources are, where the rare resources are, but also where are those opportunities to make big differences. Shown in these photographs illustrates some of those examples where when we can go in and remove dams, replace, repair culverts, stabilizing eroding stream banks, we get tremendous gains and benefits for those ecosystems. We connect the fish communities so that they can create and make full use of the system. In some cases, just doing that simple act will alleviate the impairment and restore the biology. So DNR staff are involved in all facets of this implementation work, from the assessment work to the strategy development to the planning part of it to the design part and ultimately an implementation assistance. We're sort of behind the scenes supporting the other agencies and supporting our local governments. You can go to the next slide, Katrina. Oh, this is just, there was a nice little photo that showed up late there. I apologize for that. It was just illustrating the way we can prioritize some of those protection efforts. Where do we get the most bang for the buck in terms of shoreline protection, habitat protection, forest management activities, riparian corridors, the things that we know lead to clean water? Next slide. What I really wanted to emphasize here today is the importance of both building but also maintaining a modern water network. We have built for the state of Minnesota a tremendous stream flow monitoring network. You can see that in the right-hand corner of the slide, the stream gauge network there. I realize the text is hard to read in terms of size, but you can just see how we have now monitoring all throughout the state. Before the Clean Water Fund, we had a fraction of these watersheds being monitored the way that we are now. And it's not important just for assessment. This is the way that we're going to be able to know, are the things we're doing making a difference? Are they making things better? What's left to do? This is our ability to measure our performance. And likewise, we've more than doubled the state's groundwater monitoring network with the assistance of the Clean Water Funds in the lower right-hand corner with the blue dots. But you can see we still have a long way to go. The Clean Water Council has established in their strategic plan a goal, and this budget helps us achieve that goal for completing that modern network. We're working to better understand the health of our lakes. We're collecting fish throughout the state and identifying those systems that are in the protection category versus those that may need a little bit more love for restoration. And finally, but the fish contaminants, Paul talked about mercury. So there's not much that we can do to keep the amount of mercury falling in Minnesota lakes, but there's a lot we can do to make sure that Minnesotans understand and have the best guidance available as to how much mercury is in the fish that they're consuming. The Clean Water Fund has allowed us to double the number of lakes that we sample and collect the mercury information in the fish themselves, not just in the water body, but what's actually in the fish. And then finally, the forest BMPs. The working forest landscape is important for water quality. But part of a working forest landscape, just like in agriculture, is to use the best management practices. This program allows us to go around the state, monitor those practices, and then share that information with the forest managers and help them have the best information on how they're doing and how they're performing and how that's helping water quality. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And we thank the author for this bill and the opportunity to talk about clean water funding and the council and the governor's proposals as well. So you've already heard then from PCA and DNR about monitoring and water quality, working forward with the next step in watershed planning and the watershed management framework. It's planning and implementation based on what we learn. So Bowser's portion of this proposal then works with local partners, including soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts, and counties, with the approach of local planning and prioritization of resource concerns, then targeting specific actions on how to address those concerns, and finally being able to measure what we've done. Next slide, please. So how does this implementation work? The conservation continuum is really around landowner choice, and it occurs along a spectrum or continuum of options for private landowners. And so examples of the Clean Water Fund proposal on the bottom half of this slide include things like for technical assistance, we need to create a trained and a knowledgeable local workforce to be able to design and construct and oversee the construction of these projects. Landowners may be interested in contracts like cover crop contracts. They may be interested in some short-term land retirement, and so these might be those 10-year incentive payments in urban areas to capture water as it sifts through permeable filters and maybe is reused on a golf course. In ag land, maybe a sediment control basin to slow down and let sediment settle out. And then perpetual land retirement on this part of the continuum, things like this proposal contains easement programs like the Wellhead Protection Program for drinking water. Next slide, please. So two quick examples. The first one is Serpent Lake in Crow Wing County. So this lake was experiencing declining water quality, and Bowser awarded the Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation District a targeted watershed grant from Clean Water Funds for projects to reverse the trend. So the Crow Wing Soil and Water Conservation District worked with local partners, including a very active local lake association. And when these phosphorus reduction projects were complete, there were some newly adopted ordinances in place. The district determined that the practices funded by this grant are going to reduce phosphorus by over 40%. And the reason that that's significant is because that's the amount that's needed to reverse the declining trend of water quality and to meet the whole lake's goal for phosphorus. So that's why you see that 100% there. These projects are going to meet that goal. One more example. This one is in Scott County. So this is Sand Creek. Sand Creek had multiple impairments in the creek and in its tributaries. And so Bowser awarded a $2 million Clean Water Fund grant to the Scott Watershed Management Organization to address some specific projects. And so here's really where, you know, the prioritization happened, and then you'll see here under the results the targeting. So there were targeted riparian improvement projects. There was targeted in-lake phosphorus reduction, targeted places for nutrient management, native grass plantings. And the Water Management Organization now estimates that these implemented practices are keeping out over 1,300 tons of sediment and over 1,300 pounds of phosphorus out of lakes like McMahon Lake and Cedar Lake every year. And so what this results in is we're just over a 20% reduction in all of the sediment that's headed into Sand Creek. Thank you. Now we'll turn it over to the Department of Health.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Tani Eschenauer, and I serve as Water Policy Manager for the Minnesota Department of Health. Let's go back one slide, please. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to briefly share about our Clean Water Fund initiatives that address challenges and threats to our vision of safe drinking water for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota. There's also a handout that gives more detail than I'm able to provide here. My son often sends me photos of water towers from around the state. With his most recent photo, he also texted, "Hey, Mom, did you ever notice how many cities are named after water towers?" Well, of course, the humor is in the reversal of the sequence of naming, but besides pointing to the iconic nature of water towers, it underscores the realization that a reliable, accessible supply of safe drinking water is essential for a healthy community and a healthy economy. The Clean Water Council recognizes this in their first goal of the strategic plan, drinking water is safe for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota. Drinking water includes public water systems that are regulated by MDH, the Safe Drinking Water Act, and also private wells, where we regulate location and construction of the well, but ultimately the safety of the well depends on the vigilance of the owner. Next slide, please. In our work to anticipate threats and challenges to drinking water, we know that we need to do more work upstream. The Safe Drinking Water Act protects against about 100 contaminants, but with 80,000 chemicals in use in the United States, it's essential that we protect our sources and keep contaminants out of the drinking water supply. MDH cannot do this alone, especially the broader work of source water protection that depends on actions and changes outside of our regulatory role. There are many efforts of our sister agencies within this bill that also contribute to drinking water protection. We also value our partners in local government, both old and new, and landowners and businesses. Our source water protection effort achieved its 2020 goal of delineating drinking water supply management areas, or the area that drains to a community well, for all 525 community systems that had high risk or vulnerable wells. We've also piloted work on doing protection plans for surface water systems, the first one being Fairmont, which also had the first surface water violation for nitrate. It was unthinkable in the past, but it's part of our new reality. We've also handed out more than 950 grants for source water protection. These are the little engine that could of the water grant world. They have a ceiling of $10,000, but they also leverage another dollar for dollar invested, and they made a huge difference in taking plans and turning them into implementation actions on the ground. In the next biennium, we anticipate doing more surface water intake protection plans, especially the big three of St. Cloud, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. And we're also in the process of building out a source water surveillance system. We rely on our colleagues at the Department of Agriculture and the Pollution Control Agency to do the initial look for contaminants. And then based on their data, we prioritize both contaminants, sources, and finished water to sample them as needed. It's a structured step-by-step approach to surveillance that is selected based on data and prioritization. Our new goal, also in the Clean Water Council's strategic plan, is to focus on protecting the most high-risk or vulnerable drinking water supply management acres. Next slide, please. Quickly, just a few touch points about our other Clean Water Fund initiatives. The Contaminants of Emerging Concern program, in spite of almost all the staff being reassigned to COVID response, still managed to reevaluate PFOS, one of the PFAS group of chemicals based on a new cancer report. They also developed guidance for biphenyl, and they've made progress on reviewing PFHXA, another one of the PFAS group. And our groundwater restoration and protection strategies, an interagency group that's led by MDH, we prepared 10 watershed reports that are designed to feed into the One Watershed, One Plan planning process. We've also worked with DNR to upload new data sets to the Watershed Health Assessment Framework, making sure that current data is available to our local partners. In our future of drinking water work, we have worked with the university to do a report on ways to eliminate lead in drinking water. We did that in advance of the new revised lead and copper rule, and also completed a future drinking water report that outlines different strategies that we need to address and implement in order to protect drinking water into the future. In our private well work, we've updated our materials, we're doing outreach through labs, and we have two pilots going on where we're working with local governments to educate private well users, help them know where to get their well water tested, and then how to treat if necessary. Thank you again for this opportunity to highlight our efforts to protect Minnesota's drinking water.
Mr. Freeman, are you next?
Hello, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. Next slide, please. The PFA receives clean water funds for two specific programs that are targeted for specific types of projects. The first is the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which provides grants to help cities upgrade their water treatment facilities to meet more protective requirements to improve water quality. Since 2010, when the Clean Water Fund began, that program has funded 103 projects to cities all over the state, totaling $185 million, which is a combination of Clean Water Fund as well as bonding dollars that also are appropriated for that program. Secondly is the Small Community Wastewater Treatment Program. This program provides grants and loans to help small unsewered communities with technical assistance and construction funding to replace failing septic systems with decentralized community systems. The program provides both technical assistance grants and construction funds. Since the program began, we've funded 37 technical assistance grants for a little over $1.1 million. These are funds that communities can use to conduct site assessments and evaluate various treatment alternatives. And we've also funded 12 construction projects for $7.3 million total. So again, these are very small communities, unsewered communities that where failing septic systems are creating significant water quality problems, and the conditions are such that individual homeowners can't really repair or replace those systems as individual private systems. So the community is looking for low-cost community solutions. And with that, I'll turn it over to the Met Council.
Mr. Al-Hassan.
Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Ali Al-Hassan. I'm the manager of water supply planning. Thanks for inviting us to the committee to present about our programs. I'm not sure if you can hear me. Thank you. The Metropolitan Council Clean Water Fund programs is guided, directed, and supported by two advisory committees that has 33 members from around the metro area and participation of 72 communities who are members of 8 sub-regional groups, including large and small developed and developing communities. This is providing an example of an inclusive community-based decision-making process on how clean water fund is spent in the region with regard to water supply and water supply projects. The programs, the proposal for the clean water fund supports two programs. The first program is the Metropolitan Area Water Supply Sustainability Support Program. This is a program to support communities' effort and decision-making and projects implementation to address emerging drinking water supply threats and water supply reliability, with the main target of that program to ensure safe water and sustainable quantity. The program also, the purpose of this program is to provide cost-effective regional solutions, mainly targeting resiliency of infrastructure for the communities, and also leverage interjurisdictional coordination, collaboration to better manage our shared resources in the metro area, and also to prevent degradation of groundwater resources, protect our source of supply, which is groundwater is a source of supply for 75% of the metro residents. The second program is the Water Demand Reduction Efficiency Program, grant program. This is a cost share program to assist metro municipalities and water suppliers to implement water demand reduction and water efficiency measures. And we targeted specific measures, replacing old toilets, replacing irrigation controllers and inefficient irrigation controllers with efficient ones. This is helpful to ensure the reliability and protection of our drinking water supplies, and also to support resiliency of our water supplies. The Council Efficiency Grant Program was designed to equitably address needs of single-family homes, mainly targeting outdoor water use, and multi-family units, apartments, targeting indoor water use, which is taking into consideration economic equity in the metro area. A good example of this program, when we implemented this program, community like New Brighton has used funding, about $35,000 from this grant program, to replace old toilets in one apartment complex that's resulted in 1 million gallons a year saving of water. So this program has been implemented. We always continue to evaluate our programs to make sure we are making difference toward the goals of the metro area. One example of the initiatives we supported is work done by the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program, the MINTAP, which is a program that the University of Minnesota helps Minnesota businesses and other entities develop and implement industry-tailored solutions that prevent pollution at the source, maximize efficient use of resources, and reduce energy use and cost to improve public health and the environment. This partnership has begun in 2012 with funding provided through the Clean Water Fund. Through 2019, the Met Council has funded real-life training experiences for 29 interns at businesses and cities throughout the metro area, with a water savings of over 230 million gallons of water a year, and a cost savings of over $1.6 million per year for those industries. And the cost for an intern is about $12,000 a year. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
And next up, we have Assistant Commissioner Place from Agriculture.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman, we're going to finish the presentation. And then if you want to answer your question, then unless it's about process.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the way things are going with amendments coming, we're not going to have any time at all for questions. Are we going to get cut off again like we have previously in committee?
I don't know what's going to happen, Representative Heintzman, but we can.
What's the timeline, Madam Chair?
The timeline is to wrap this up. And then if you look at the agenda, we're going to be moving to the bill right after this. And then we'll proceed with the amendments as we go. Ms. Place?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Vinnie Place. I serve as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Next slide, please. The Minnesota Department of Ag focuses on activities to work with farmers to implement and demonstrate conservation practices and best management practices that can improve and protect our waters, monitor for agricultural chemicals like nitrates and pesticides, and focus on protection of our state's groundwater. We also conduct and oversee research projects that show the effectiveness of conservation practices, best management practices, fertilizer recommendations, and research for new cropping systems. The Department of Agriculture recommendations total to $19.66 million. Those recommendations include around $6 million for our Ag Water Quality Certification Program, $3.3 to $4 million for our work with farmers, soil and water conservation districts, and other local partners to demonstrate and implement conservation practices that protect our waters, $6.384 million to increase water monitoring and accelerate activities to reduce nitrates in groundwater, and $3.952 million for research and implementation of perennials, winter annuals, and cover crops through the Forever Green Initiative and operation of the Minnesota Water Research Digital Library. Next slide, please. With our short time today, I wanted to highlight the outcomes achieved through our Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program. This is a voluntary program that helps farmers address any risks to water quality through a site-specific whole farm assessment. We are really excited to have recently reached the milestone of our 1,000th certified farm, and you can see some of the outcomes that we've achieved since implementation of the program began. Governor Walz has set a goal of achieving 1 million certified acres by the end of 2022 in this program. This program is really built on partnerships with the farmers who come forward to be certified, with our critical local partners like Soil and Water Conservation District technical staff, and with state and federal partners, including all of the state agencies that we coordinate with presenting today. The investment in this program has leveraged an initial $9 million in federal funding to implement conservation practices through the NRCS Regional Conservation Partnership Program. And we are just finalizing the contract for an additional $9 million that will go directly toward implementation of practices on Minnesota's ag lands. Over the past year, the program has also incorporated 4 new endorsements for soil health, integrated pest management, wildlife, and climate smart farms. Those endorsements are awarded to certification growers who are going above and beyond to implement conservation on their farms and recognize their many conservation practices that directly provide benefits and serve conservation goals beyond water quality. Thank you so much to the committee for your time and consideration of our proposals.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we're done. So we're happy to stand for questions. Really appreciate the committee's time today.
All right, Chair Hansen, we're gonna move to the bill now. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move that House File 639 be recommended to be re-referred to the Legacy Finance Committee.
I understand you also have an author's amendment. Representative Hansen, do you wanna move the DE2 amendment so we can get it before the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'll move the DE2 amendment.
Representative Hansen moves the DE2 amendment to get the bill before the committee. All those in favor of the DE2 amendment being added on, please say aye.
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 Aye. All those opposed?
No.
No.
The amendment is adopted. Representative Hansen, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to move the A1 amendment. I believe that's the technical amendment that was coming, just to get it further into shape.
Okay, Representative Hansen moves the A1 amendment as well. All those in favor of the A1 amendment?
Aye.
All those opposed?
No.
No.
The A1 amendment is adopted as well. Representative Hansen, to the bill as amended by those two amendments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like Ms. Taylor and Mr. Hagemeyer to walk through the bill as amended by the DE2 and subsequent A1.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I will start with the spreadsheet and I can share my screen so you can quickly see that. I think, sorry, is everyone seeing the spreadsheet right at the moment? Okay. As you'll see, there's just, I'll just go with the changes from the governor's record to make this fairly quick. In the Department of Agriculture, you'll see that there was $628,000 added to the Forever Green Agricultural Initiative. That was the only fiscal change in Department of Ag, so appropriates $20.228 million to Department of Agriculture. On lines, or starting on line 12, the PCA, you'll see there are 3 changes. On line 22, you'll see the Clean Water Council budget was increased. There are some requirements later in the bill that Ms. Taylor will show you that will help be used for. Sorry. On line 23, you'll see We Are Water Minnesota is removed from the governor's recommendations in the DE2 here. And on line 24, you'll see that there is some language and requirements for testing protocols and some implementation for microplastics and nanoplastics. And then is 2.353 million. So in total, the PCA would get $43.837 million. On the next page, you'll see there's one change to the Department of Natural Resources. That would be $350,000 was added for the creation of a groundwater management area in Dakota County. In total, DNR would be receiving $17.7 million. Starting on line 37, you'll see the Board of Water and Soil Resources. There are a handful of changes here. On line 46, you'll see the Conservation Drainage Management and Assistance was removed. There on line 48, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program had $792,000 added to it, and it was shifted into the second year to make the budget work. And then if you drop down to line 54, you'll see the SWCD administration grants were added in for $12 million in the first year. When we go through the bill, you'll see that the language is slightly different than it has been in the past. In the second year, you'll see three technical assistance and implementation grant programs, each for $4.7 million, addressing soil health practices for groundwater protection, soil health practices for wind erosion to protect surface waters, and sustainable forestry and soil health practices to protect surface and groundwater. In total, the Board of Water and Soil Resources would be receiving $134,256,000. On to the next page, you'll see there is one change for the Department of Health. There was $1.5 million added for three health risk limits that are added later in the bill that you'll see when Ms. Taylor goes through it. In total, the Department of Health receives $13.4 million. The Met Council had two changes added into the DE2. There were inflow and infiltration grants of $2.5 million in the first year. And then in the second year, there's $2.5 million for lead service line replacement grants. In total, the Met Council would be receiving $7.3 million. There was one change to the University of Minnesota. That was the $1.378 million for chronic wasting disease in water research. In total, the U of M would be receiving $3.8 million. The LCC has a little bit of money for the website, and then there's $16 million going to the PFA still, with no changes there. In total, this bill spends $36.545 million over the governor's recommendation, and that brings it to exactly the 5% statutory reserve amount. And that is all I have.
Ms. Taylor, I think you're up next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go through the DE2 language. And just in the interest of time, I'm just going to point out differences from the governor's bill, which was House File 1079, if anyone's interested. The first thing I'll point out is there's some additional language for microplastics and nanoplastics added to seven different riders. And I'm not going to point out each one just because we're running short on time. But these are riders for the agency's work, like assessment and monitoring work, and microplastics and nanoplastics was added. The next thing I'll point out is on the Forever Green rider on page 4. There had been language in the governor's bill regarding the efficiency, profitability, and productivity of farmers, and that has been removed in this one. And then the next I point out on page 7, the Clean Water Council administration, there is some additional language added on line 7.23 that would allow the Clean Water Council to use the money for consultants and assistants for some reports that are required later on in the bill. And then on the bottom of page 7, there's the new rider for the developing protocols for the testing of the microplastics and nanoplastics. Then the next thing I'd want to point out is on page 9, towards the bottom, on line 27 through 30. This is the new rider from giving DNR money for the groundwater management area in Dakota County. And then we'll skip ahead to page 15. On the bottom, you'll see the rider letter P starting on line 32. This is the first of the new SWCD grant program. This is the $12 million the first year. And as Mr. Hagemeyer pointed out, that the criteria is slightly different. If you look at lines 16.1 through 16.6 on the following page, you'll see the new criteria. That's some of it's new and some of it's old based on the previous times. And then the next two riders for the 4.7, those are allocated to three different grant pools, as Mr. Hagemeyer mentioned. And then I point out on the bottom of page 16, 16.34, the amount of contract work with the Conservation Corps was increased from $500,000 to $750,000. And then I'd skip ahead to page 19. This is the new rider on the bottom, line 29 through 33 for the INI. And then on page 20 at the top, line 1 through 6, this is the new rider for the lead service lines. You'll see that the stuff is targeted to environmental justice areas as determined by this PCA. And then I point on page 21, the rider for the chronic wasting disease prion research. This is language very similar to Representative Becker Finn's bill from last session. And then I'd skip ahead to section 12. This is new language that would allow counties to add a $25 fee to mortgage transactions. And then this would be dedicated for SWCDs, and it would be appropriated out to them. And then section 13 is a new provision that would limit counties' eligibility for clean water funds to those who impose that new fee or that have a watershed district or similar organization representing at least 75% of the county. And then section 14 on page 23 is the health risk limits that were mentioned previously. This is the language we heard from the previous bill plus the addition of the two neonics. And then section 15 is a report requirement of the Clean Water Council. There's three different things they would need to report back on. One would be an assessment on the use of LIDAR from previously funded Clean Water Fund appropriations. Another would be an assessment of this recent Supreme Court decision regarding groundwater and the application of water quality standards. And then the third would be an evaluation of state agency personnel using clean water that are funded with Clean Water Fund money. Then the final section is a requirement for the Clean Water Council to develop an RFP to study the impacts of a chemical compound that's derived from rubber tire additives that has been shown to impact fish and water quality. And that concludes that. And if anyone's interested in the other riders with the microplastics, I can send people the exact citations.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. We're going to switch things up a little bit here.
Madam Chair.
Chair Hansen, yes.
So we've been checking to see if we could go over Representative Heinzman, and we are unable to, but we are able to lay it over for till tomorrow. We would cut a couple bills from the agenda tomorrow. And so what I would maybe suggest is we get the testifiers and then take your amendment up so that it's on the table when we come back tomorrow. I don't know if that's a effort for you. Okay.
I thank you. I was actually going to make that a suggestion. So that makes a lot more sense. That should work.
So we're thinking the same, Representative Heinzman.
All right. So we're going to move to testifiers. That's my understanding of what's happening next. Just want to clarify that. And first up, we have Brian Martinson. Mr. Martinson, if you can identify yourself for the record.
Hello, Madam Chair and members. I'm Brian Martinson, Environment and Natural Resources Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. We represent all 87 counties of the state. I'll keep my comments brief. Thank you for the opportunity to comment on House File 639 as amended. I'd like to address two issues in the proposed DE2 amendment. First, a missed opportunity to address 2 years of the state contribution to SWCD capacity funding without needing to reduce any of the council's recommendations, as has been done in the past three budget cycles. We appreciate the bill's author in getting us halfway there with his amendment and would encourage you to consider moving to include both years of funding as you continue to work on the bill. The next item is concerns we have with sections 12 and 13 of the delete all. The structure of this proposal in Section 12 raises questions about the economic, functional, and managerial impacts, as well as whether this offers stable and reliable funding for districts, and concern that this appears to be a substitute for direct state support. As you can imagine, there's a good deal of difference from county to county on the number of transactions, and it fluctuates from year to year, creating inconsistencies and uncertainty for funding. We do oppose Section 13, which would restrict county access to Clean Water Fund grants if the fee is not imposed. Counties do good work on behalf of their residents and the people of Minnesota with clean water funds. That includes the One Watershed, One Plan grants, where we partner with other local jurisdictions to address water issues through a comprehensive and coordinated watershed approach. AMC shares the belief with others that district funding should be a state and local partnership. We have supported efforts to secure stable state support, and total county funding has been growing. In 2017, county funding totaled approximately $18.5 million. Of that, nearly $11 million was county annual allocations, not program dollars. Counties appreciate the coordination and cooperation we have with SWCDs, and AMC looks forward to working with them, the author, and the legislature on a long-term solution for district funding, including the state chair. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, we have Paul Egger. If you can identify yourself for the record, and we do need to be brief, very brief here, so we can get through all the testifiers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Egger, and I'm Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Minnesota Realtors is a statewide business trade association with a membership of over 21,000 real estate professionals working with buyers and sellers of all types of property in every corner of the state. Thank you for the opportunity to testify regarding our opposition to Section 12 of the DE2 amendment, which would authorize new $25 surcharges on both the mortgage registry and deed taxes. Minnesota Realtors opposes increasing the cost of home ownership. We also do not believe the real estate transaction should be responsible for funding programs and activities that benefit all Minnesotans. By adding these surcharges to the existing and regressive mortgage registry and deed taxes, this proposal will increase the cost of housing. These fees will also make an already random and confusing tax and fee structure more so, and I encourage you to read the letter submitted by the Minnesota Association of County Officers on that topic. In fiscal year 2019, buyers and sellers paid over $256 million in mortgage registry and deed taxes. For each of those taxes, 97% goes to the general fund and 3% is retained by counties. In addition, there's a county conservation fee of $5 that is added to the mortgage registry and deed taxes in the 10 counties that participate in the Minnesota Ag Land Preservation Program. And finally, you get to the recording fees. And just to highlight this, a typical seller who was also buying their next home would pay the deed tax, a $46 recording fee for paying off their mortgage on the house they're selling. They'd pay the mortgage registry tax on the house they're buying. They pay the $46 recording fee for the mortgage registry, and then pay the $46 recording fee to record the deed. It's past time to stop increasing and adding fees on the purchase of a home. Please reject these new surcharges. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Next up, I have Doug Carnival. Mr. Carnival, if you can identify yourself for the record and briefly present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug Carnival, the Grand Shea Carnival Law Firm in Minneapolis, representing the Minnesota chapter of the National Waste and Recycling Association, and I too will be brief. We represent the landfills that are receivers of used up waste products that may either intentionally or unintentionally contain PFAS. But we're not producers or generators of PFAS products, but rather manage products at the end of their useful life. As such, we support an upstream approach that focuses on the product sources of PFAS in the waste stream. Our concern with the DE2 amendment is the precedent setting language that legislates an arbitrary standard of 15 parts per billion. No other state in the union has as stringent a standard as we understand, and the economic burden of meeting this standard will be unfairly borne by all solid waste facilities, wastewater treatment facilities, and others who are merely receiving of spent used up products at the end of their useful life. we have a better way to do this. The administrative rulemaking process provides an opportunity for all parties to be heard, research to be done, and fully vetting to look at the issue involved and then promulgating a rule. It includes an economic analysis of the rule, and that's why the SONAR, or Statement of Need and Reasonableness, makes sense with an opportunity for people to participate. In our opinion, the legislative process falls short of this and doesn't provide a comprehensive and methodical way to analyze this 15 parts per billion statute, especially from an economic standpoint. It doesn't give the public a needed opportunity nor scientific individuals to weigh in. As a result, we oppose the establishment of the PFAS HRL through legislation, and our focus our efforts on the generators of the products rather than the recipients. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next up, we have Sheila Vanni. If you can identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sheila Vanni, Assistant Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We represent the state's 88 SWCDs, including their 440 elected supervisors and their more than 460 employees. SWCDs are political subdivisions of the state established under Minnesota State Statute Chapter 103C. Each SWCD is governed by a board of elected supervisors, and SWCD law is implemented across 100% of the state. We appreciate the opportunity to speak today to the DE amendment for House File 639 and thank Chair Hansen for bringing it forward. Of particular interest to us are the provisions that start toward the bottom of page 15 and continue on to page 16 of the amendment, as well as the deed tax provisions that were spoken to by Mr. Martinson and Mr. Egger. First, I want to convey our appreciation for the recognition that these provisions give to the need for state funding for SWCDs and the need for enhancing local funding of SWCDs. We, too, see the need for funding SWCDs as being a shared obligation of both state and local resources. SWCDs have no authority to raise their own revenue and are entirely reliant on our partners at the state and counties for meeting our funding needs. We are now in our third biennium or sixth year of what we call SWCD capacity grants, which have been a legislatively directed appropriation out of the Clean Water Fund. What we mean when we say SWCD capacity is the readiness and ability of SWCDs to plan, identify, and successfully accomplish water quality solutions. Funding local capacity leads to SWCDs being able to execute priorities and commitments in their locally developed and state-approved plans, and to implement the programs and priorities of the Clean Water Fund and statutorily required SWCD duties. These include wetland conservation, soil erosion and soil health, the Reinvest in Minnesota Reserve Easement Program, and the Minnesota Ag Water Quality Certification Program, just to name a few. Our SWCD capacity grants have leveraged additional county appropriations to SWCDs at the local level, and enhanced SWCD staffing has bolstered our readiness in leveraging federal funding. All of this work is lined up with the priorities and objectives of the Clean Water Fund and is reported to the Board of Water and Soil Resources through our eLink reporting system. Specifically, with regard to the language,
Mean for SWCD. We do need you to wrap up. We have two more testifiers we have to get through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're still trying to understand the exact implications for the language, but I want to recognize that MPCA's statewide monitoring and assessment data and information from MPCA through their watershed restoration and protection strategies feeds into our local planning and our local priority setting. And we're concerned that the specific pollutant concerns mentioned in the bill will force us to readjust our efforts, or add to our already identified pollutant concerns, which will require additional capacity funding beyond what we're already seeking. So in closing, Madam Chair, I just would like to, again, convey our appreciation for the opportunity to speak and look forward to SWCDs being part of the discussions going forward. Thank you.
Next up, we have Amber Boyge from the Minnesota Association of County Officers. If you can present your testimony and identify yourself and be brief, please.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Amber Boyge, and I serve as the Chief Deputy Recorder for Hennepin County. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association's Legislative Committee. While the Minnesota County Recorders Association agrees that clean water is an important cause, an added surcharge to the recording fee is not the appropriate funding source for such an initiative. The uniform fees for recording were established in 2005 and supported by a wide-ranging coalition of interests, including the Minnesota County Recorders Association, the Minnesota Land Title Association, the Real Property Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and the Minnesota Realtors. This legislation is now used as a model for similar legislation throughout the country. These predictable fees are designed to ensure that each county recording office charges uniform fees that allow our industry partners to transact businesses with our office and support real estate commerce in our state. The current recording fee is standard across the state. Title companies and others who may rely on recording services know that there is only one uniform recording fee for all counties. This brings simplification and uniformity to the real estate industry, especially those who operate in all or multiple counties. Predictable recording fees
Ms.
are
Bougie,
desired.
Ms. Bougie, we're at the end of our committee time. We're going to have to have you wrap up with your last
question. Okay. So we do not oppose the attempt to fund clean water, just using the recording fee as a mechanism. And there are many benefits of predictable fees that are outlined in the letter that we submitted yesterday.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Chair Hansen.
I would move that House File 639 as amended be laid on the table to be taken up tomorrow. Vote.
We'll lay that on the table. Do we have to vote on that? Someone remind me.
I think it's a lay on the table that we actually do need to vote.
Okay, so the clerk will take the roll on that motion.
Hanson, Rick.
Aye.
Hanson, aye. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heinzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heinzman, aye. Akram, Patty.
Aye.
Ackland, Susan.
Aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Becker, aye.
Becker, aye. Beckerpin, Jamie.
Aye.
Beckerpin, aye. Eklund, Rob.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
Aye.
Green, aye. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Sydney.
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale. Lewick, Dale. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Aye.
Tice, aye. Lewick, Dale. Lewick, Dale. That is 18 ayes, 0 nays.
The bill is laid on the table for future discussion. And with that, members, we are adjourned.